Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 514th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Al. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. And Alberta is where I met our next speaker, and that is Betsy Thomas. Betsy, do you want to introduce yourself, say a little bit about where you work, all that kind of fun stuff?
Sounds good, Mike. My name is Betsy Thomas, and I'm a clinical evidence expert at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, as well as a member of the peer team. And I'm also an assistant adjunct professor at the University of Alberta in the Department of Family Medicine. Prior to joining CFPC, I worked in primary care as a pharmacist for many, many years. And I'm excited to be here today, as it's my first time on the podcast.
And it's great.
Hopefully and not the last.
Well, you know, we won't judge yet. I'm already annoyed because both your and Mike introductions for yourselves are longer than mine. It's a little hurtful, actually. I was going to say it's not hurtful. It is a little hurtful.
You could regale us with stories about how you've insulted hockey players.
Oh, yeah.
That people in the media.
Yeah, it goes without saying, Mike. So we'll just ignore that. So we got an interesting topic today. It's a very, very common condition, yet there are lots of different treatments. So Betsy, how do you guys come up with this question? Where'd that all come from?
Yeah, so the question that we looked at was antihistamines for allergic rhinosinusitis. And this TFP came up because specifically, I had heard of the newer antihistamines, and I knew that they were more expensive than the ones that were available. And for me, I wanted to know, are they any better, because they were being prescribed. And so that's kind of what started off on this journey. But when we started to look at the evidence, we found that it was hard to find specific evidence comparing the newer ones compared to the old ones. And it ended up being tools for practice that we wrote about many different interventions specifically focused on oral antihistamines compared to other things.
Yeah. And I think it's important because there's more than just antihistamines that we use. And we'll talk about the different treatments that we have because, it's great to just talk about antihistamines, but if you have other things that might be as effective or not more effective, it's always useful to look for that evidence. So what did you guys find?
So the first thing I'll go over is antihistamines versus placebo. So we found two systematic reviews. The first one was from 2005, so a little bit older. And they looked at patient-rated nasal obstruction scores. So patients started on a scale. So it was a score of 0 to 3, and the baseline score was 1.65. And patients who were on antihistamines changed or improved by 48% compared to 16% on patients who are on placebo. So that was a 32% difference.
Right. And what that might mean on the scale is you go from about a 1.65, and if you're on placebo, you get to 1.35. And if you're on drug, you get to 0.85 on the scale. So it's likely a meaningful difference. This is a 4-point scale, and the difference is about 0.4, 0.5 difference, or 30%. We often set what's a meaningful difference. It's probably around 30, and that's exactly what Dave just explained. So it's probably a meaningful difference in scale.
Yeah, and that's for antihistamines versus placebo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was a second systematic review we found that was newer. It was actually published this year in 2022, a little bit larger, had over 3,000 patients. And it was actually looking at one of the newer antihistamines, which is bilastine, compared to placebo. And we found that the antihistamine improved symptoms about 10 to 16% over placebo. So even some more recent evidence to show that, you know, it seems like antihistamines do work for sinusitis compared to placebo.
Yeah, rhinosinusitis. And other ones we looked at found similar, eh? Eh, Betsy? Like, it's not like these things, they work. They're not, even despite the name of, it sounds like blastine, but it's bilastine. And I always think that, well, we always make the joke, it works like dynamite. That sounds like it might actually be dynamite, but it's, And you know, one of the things that's interesting here is that we originally, your question was, do the new ones work better than the old ones? And I'll say, first of all, they're newer, so of course they work better.
Well, that, I mean, that's a given, right? You don't need to do studies.
We don't need any research to show that new is better than old. The very word indicates that. So but it was a real good question. Our first problem, and Betsy, you can maybe speak to this, is we had trouble even defining what is new. And is it third generation? And some would put some in a third generation or a second generation versus, I recall that being a challenge for us right off the hop.
Yeah, and I'd even seen, you know, some referred to as the new novel second generation. So, you know, it's different than second generation because of various different factors. So it was very difficult to classify the antihistamines into first, second, and, you know, even, I don't even know if third exists, but.
Yeah.
A fourth, a 20th.
Fourth. Yeah,
exactly. It sounds like something out of the, you know, Star Trek, sort of the second generation. And it,
exactly.
You know, and again, most of that is sort of I was going to say it's only a marketing thing, but it's not so much. I mean, people try to categorize, you know, whenever we have newer ones, we sometimes say, oh, surely to goodness, they must be better. Otherwise they wouldn't have come out. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily true, but you know, mm-hmm. You're right. It's hard to know, you know, because when someone says it's a second generation, almost by that word, you go, well, it must either be better or safer or both. And it it's not necessarily the case. And we haven't talked about that in the tools of practice, but we had a couple of antihistamines taken off the market a number of years ago, back around about 20, 25 years ago. And they were a newer version, but they showed some cardiac arrhythmia disturbances, and so they were taken off the market. So newer is never always necessarily better.
Never always.
Yeah, I'm trying to be as vague as I can.
Yeah. It's good though, because you have this premise, and I, of course, being who I am, was skeptical of that idea. And not only could we not find a lot of evidence to support that, we couldn't even clearly define what was newer versus older. So with that in mind, why don't you talk a little bit about antihistamines versus antihistamines, Betsy?
Yeah, so that's kind of what we had initially embarked on, to find whether there was any difference between the antihistamines. And we found a couple of systematic reviews. And in fact, they showed that there was no statistical or clinical differences in total or nasal symptom scores between the antihistamines. And I think some of the ones that we looked at was that newer one, belastine, cetirizine, desloratadine. And there was no difference. There might have been a few statistical differences, but when you looked at the change on scales, they were so small that they clinically they probably weren't meaningful. Right, Mike?
Yeah, they couldn't even approach a meaningful difference. I remember that clearly. I remember we spent forever sorting out, trying to pull out the math of them, which was really challenging. And then you would get it to the point where the differences were a few percentage change on a scale. That was statistical different and often promoted by the conclusions as being, you know, this is different and therefore likely better in this way. And it would be one subscale of a variety of scales that it was 1 to 2% better. And, you know, James, I know you've looked at antihistamines before. I'm going to go out on a limb and say this, what we're telling you is no surprise to you from when you've looked at it before.
No. And we'll get into some of the more, the older treatments. But I think what's really important is that basically it doesn't matter what antihistamine you choose, whether it be diphenhydramine, chlorpheniramine, fexofenadine, cetirizine, any of those, they all seem to be equally effective. With the caveat that sometimes it may only work, a particular one may only work in a particular person, but in general, you can't choose based on efficacy. And so we're going to get into the issue in a little bit about toxicity, and even that's a bigger mess than efficacy. But the good thing, I think the important message there is no difference in efficacy between these agents.
Right. And I think that's such an important message, that you could literally send someone down to the drugstore, and if cost was no, you know, concern or side effects, they could literally grab anyone off the shelf.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, Betsy, what about the other agents? Because there's other things we can do for, you know, basically a stuffy nose. That's what we're talking about here. So,
yeah, sure. I'll walk you through some of that. So this was probably the most surprising evidence that came up for me out of all of the things that we looked at. So we looked at two systematic reviews that compared intranasal corticosteroids to antihistamines. And they looked at that over 2 to 8 weeks. And when you looked at total nasal symptom scores, they improved with intranasal corticosteroids by about 51% compared to 31% with antihistamine. So that's a difference of 20%. And we were actually able to find some responder data for this as well, and found that 78% of patients on the steroids attained moderate control or better compared to 58% on antihistamines, with a difference, once again, of 20% or numbers needed to treat of 5. Yeah. So to me, that was quite surprising, because typically I would go to an antihistamine first for patients who presented with allergy symptoms.
Yeah, and I think it's important because I'm going to sort of make up a number here, but if you probably had a placebo in that group, you're probably talking maybe, what, 30%?
Maybe.
Something like that. So you know, both antihistamines and the intranasal steroids are more effective than placebo, and it certainly looks like intranasal steroids are more effective. And I think one of the advantages of that, and we've talked about this in many, many podcasts, if it's possible to put the drug where the problem is, that's an advantage.
Yeah, that's a huge advantage. You know, I remember when these drugs came out, when we started to use nasal corticosteroids, and they were like, it was kind of like PPIs versus, you know, the
H2 receptor. Blocker. Yeah, the H2. Yeah. The
yeah. H2. Yeah. Like that step was how much better. It, maybe not quite that, but darn close.
Yeah, you're right. Yep. Yeah, I would agree.
These things were a lot better. Now they have side effects like epistaxis and stuff, which again, classic for clinical trials, had a hard time finding that data, but yeah. You certainly know from clinical experience that occurs.
Yeah.
But I was really surprised, and surprised also by colleagues as this circulated around, how few of them thought or knew that the corticosteroids and were so much better.
Yeah. And now not everyone loves spraying something up their nose. But you know, it's not that uncomfortable. But if it does bother you, then you might want to go with something like an antihistamine. But the problem is that now you have a systemic effect.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah, you don't get a lot of sedation from a nasal steroid.
Well, it depends. You probably do if you were. It wouldn't be above the placebo group.
That's true, yeah. Right? And yeah. Betsy, what about when you add an antihistamine or add a nasal steroid to like one to the other?
Yeah, so we did find a systematic review that looked at that as well, which was also surprising because we think about a stepwise approach. If something doesn't work, do we add something else? So this was looking at adding an antihistamine to intranasal corticosteroids versus intranasal corticosteroids alone, and found that adding antihistamines didn't actually add any clinically meaningful benefit. And we found some other systematic reviews that found similar results as well. So that was the second thing that was surprising for me when we were going through this evidence.
Yeah, and I think, you know, given that piece of information, one, you may think about starting with intranasal steroids first, and we'll get to the issue of cost in a minute. But certainly if you aren't getting a benefit from likely one or the other, you would stop it and just switch. You wouldn't add.
Yeah. Because I think what happened in these clinical trials is because most people were benefiting from steroids, the amount added on from antihistamines was so small for lack of a better term, the yeoman's work was done.
Right.
So you're not going to get a lot more added on from the antihistamines. And again, it is a bit frustrating, and I can't say that I would never make that combination again in desperation, but it's for the majority of patients, there'd be little point in starting both.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then there's one other class of agents that are used.
Yeah, we found actually, we looked at leukotriene receptor antagonists, so like montelukast, and found two systematic reviews. comparing antihistamines versus the leukotriene receptor antagonist, and again found no clinically meaningful differences between the two groups. So, which basically translates to, you know, one doesn't necessarily work better than the other. And we did find a systematic review adding a leukotriene receptor antagonist to an antihistamine to see if that would make a difference, but you know, there were some outcomes that showed that was statistically significant, but just like the antihistamines or what we spoke about before, this translated to a change in on a 4-point scale of about 0.1. So you're really not going to notice that difference.
Yeah. And the good thing about it, all of these systematic reviews and the studies, they were all perfectly well done, right? There was
They were dynamite.
There was, there was no issue with them.
Problem with them. And, you know, just one thing about the leukotriene receptor antagonist, this is a drug that's looking for a home.
Yeah.
And it still hasn't found it yet, James. So, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's like the old Cromolyn.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Cromolyn salts.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Intol. That's another drug that needs a home.
Yeah.
So maybe you could steward this and find a home for it, James.
No, I am not going to do it. There's no home for, we have enough drugs that don't work. We don't need another home for drugs that really don't work.
Yeah. So why don't you talk about the limitations, Betsy, a bit?
Well, I would say one of the biggest ones we found was when we were looking at what was measured, they had so many different scales in the systematic reviews or in the RCTs that we actually, you know, peeked into. So one of the main ones we found was a total nasal symptom score, which was a score from 0 to 12. But then you would find another systematic review that says it's out of 24 because they were measuring twice a day. And then there's the total symptom score, which included nasal scores plus non-nasal scores. And then they had total daytime nasal symptoms and total nighttime nasal symptoms. So it was very hard to actually sift through all of this evidence and figure out what you could actually compare.
Right. And the ones that were out of 12, sometimes they would, because it was an addition of four different scales to the total scale, they would divide by four and make it out of 0 to 3 again. And so it could either be 0 out of 3, out of 12, or out of 24 if it was
24.
And it was interchangeable and moving all the time. And in the metagraphs, they would often combine them in the metagraph using different. Yep. So they would use an RCT that had a different scale for the same measurement. So their change of one could be the exact same as a change of four on the other scale, but it sure didn't look like it. And it's a complete schmoz. Yeah. I said schmoz, not schnoz.
Yeah, but that is an evidence-based term.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I think you'll find it in the user's guide. It's in the grade book at the back. If you look careful, it's in there. This is like the kind of old X-Files show. And I knew that it would be like this when they chose this topic.
Oh, yeah. It's.
The truth is out there, but you're likely never going to find it.
Yeah. But you can imagine all of these things is why most people in the peer group drink heavily. It's because it's so painful to go through this stuff. Although we're all weird enough that we get a kick out of trying to figure out what the hell is going on with these things. So it's kind of interesting. But at least from an efficacy perspective, that's the best evidence that we've got. And I don't think we need any more studies to guide us.
No, we don't need.
Yeah.
These work not well, but they work.
Yeah.
And steroids in the nose work even better.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the key issue, and we'll get to some of the context is, but what about the adverse events? Because, you know, I don't think you can watch more than about an hour of TV without an advertisement coming on for antihistamine saying, you know, non-sedating, less sedating, all of these sorts of things. But you guys looked at that as well, right?
We did. And unfortunately, the adverse event data, once again, was very infrequently reported, which was really frustrating because if the antihistamines are similar in efficacy, then maybe one of the things that you would look at would be adverse events or adverse effects. So we did try to look at what they had, and they were, you know, poorly reported, they were inconsistent, and not always clinically interpretable. So what we did find was, compared to placebo, I don't think this is a surprise, that diphenhydramine was mild or moderately more sedating. Mm-hmm. So that was an effect size of 0.36. So that was, you know, kind of in that moderate zone, I guess.
Yeah, it's really hard to say, because you often couldn't find how many people were sedated or any of that sort of data.
Which is like the absolute, it's unbelievable they don't have that information. Like, how many people said they felt tired?
Right.
Oh, can't get that.
Yeah. And I would imagine some of this stuff is, you know, it makes a big difference. Are you talking about a single dose, or are you talking about if you take it for, you know, a couple of weeks? Because for many, many medications, the sedating effect can go away. But, you know, I'm sure the data wasn't clear enough for you to figure that out.
Oh, God, no.
No.
And some of it was fascinating. Like, when you would look at the study that compared diphenhydramine versus second generation. And don't forget, now they're picking the one that's used in Nytol, right? They're picking the one they know has, or they're pretty sure has, a sedating effect. Even in that, they create these blobograms that I've never seen before. They're interesting, but difficult to interpret. But what's interesting is, in three studies, second generation antihistamines were more sedating than the diphenhydramine. Now, there's probably about 10 where diphenhydramine was more sedating, but in three of the studies, the effect size was actually in favor of the second generations being more sedating.
Yeah. No, I remember looking at this probably
all over the map.
I remember looking at this probably 25 or 30 years ago, because this same question came up all the time. And this was just as some of the second generations were coming out. And I don't even like that term, because the two we had originally were diphenhydramine and chlorpheniramine. And both of those came out in the early, or actually the mid 1940s. And you know, were basically the medications that we used as antihistamines for years and years and years. But you're right. It's impossible to get it. So when you hear that, you know, this is less sedating, more sedating, non-sedating, it's not solid data at all.
Oh, it's sketchy. It's sketchy data. And I'm surprised that instead of diphenhydramine, they didn't use hydroxine.
Hydroxyzine.
Yeah, hydroxyzine. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, Atarax, right? Which we know was so sedating, it was used as an anxiolytic for years.
Yeah. And one thing I found frustrating, we'll talk about this in a minute, is sort of my go-to antihistamine for years, and maybe even still, is being chlorpheniramine. And it was the drug that came out about 2 years after diphenhydramine. And if you look for studies that compare the two, chlorpheniramine is likely less sedating than diphenhydramine. But at that point, when it came out, no one was using the first and second generation and all that sort of stuff. So you can't really even say first generation versus second generation, because there's differences between all of these drugs. And so, and we'll get to which ones we can use in a bit, but I'm sure it was frustrating that you really can't guarantee that any of these are really non-sedating, but maybe some have slightly less sedating effects. But you may have heard it here first. I don't know if we've mentioned this before, Mike. It may be a dose thing.
No.
Yep.
No, that can't. That. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that, and when we put everything into context. So be excited that this conversation is going to happen in just a bit.
I can't wait.
Yes,
Jesse, want to finish off with all that we know and don't know. Actually, don't do all that we don't know, because we don't have enough time for that. Do what we know.
Well, we did find that some antihistamines might have less sedation, so fexofenadine versus other second generations. But again, it was such messy data that was really hard for us to interpret. But we were able to find some information looking at the newer one, bilastine, and it seems to have a little bit less sedation compared to cetirizine. So 3% for bilastine, and cetirizine was 7%. But interesting enough, I was just looking at the systematic review again, and when they looked at bilastine versus placebo, there was actually no difference. So you can see how this evidence is really really hard to interpret.
And let's say it was 3% versus 7%. I mean, really, That, I mean, now, was that 3%, 7% the percentage of people who were sedated, or was that just the degree?
Yeah, that was the percent who were
sedated. So you kind of go, okay, so 93% of people weren't sedated by either.
Yeah.
Right? So in general, so it's really tricky. So, we'll talk a little bit about some of the other drugs. What was the bottom line, at least in this tools for practice?
Well, the bottom line would basically be that oral antihistamines does reduce rhinosinusitis symptoms by about 10 to 30% versus placebo. Mm-hmm. And that antihistamines seem to have comparable efficacy to each other. Like one doesn't work better than the other. Mm-hmm. And like we've mentioned, more patients attain moderate or better improvement with intranasal corticosteroids, 78% versus antihistamines, which was 58%. And there's no difference between antihistamines and leukotrienes or in adding antihistamines to intranasal corticosteroids.
So now we have to go, so, you know, what sort of things would you recommend? And I'm going to sort of bring up my bias here a little bit because I've been doing this for years and years and years. But I remember up until about, about maybe 15, 20 years ago, the antihistamine based on the best available evidence that we always used to recommend was a drug called chlorpheniramine. Some of you, Mike, I'm sure you remember, it was called clortriprolone.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And it's been generic, the generic version's been available for years and years and years. And this sort of shows you how crappy the drug evaluation of these drugs were, you know, back in the 1940s. Because when chlorpheniramine was brought onto the market, you were told to use it, and it still says this on the label. And you actually can still get it, and I'll talk about that in a minute, that you're supposed to take it 4 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours. And if you do that, that will sedate a moose. Like, you just try it. I challenge anybody to take chlorpheniramine 4 milligrams every 4 and not be sedated. And in fact, probably it's similar to what you'd get with diphenhydramine. And but the uniqueness or the interesting thing about this is that it says it's dosed every 4 to 6 hours. It has a half-life of 17 hours. So it truly is a once-a-day antihistamine. And here's how crazy our world is sometimes. Because we know that if you say extended release or sustained release, if you make a preparation that has that property, people will buy it. They actually have developed extended or sustained release chlorpheniramine, which is ridiculous because it's already got a half-life of 17 hours. So you don't need to do that, but it just shows you some of the differences. And so for many years, one of the colleagues I worked with, who we've had on the podcast many years ago, Bob Rangno, he had terrible allergies and would always use chlorpheniramine at 4 milligrams a day and sometimes go down to 2 milligrams. And I can tell you hundreds of patients that I've talked to about this and it works for them. And the cool thing about it now, there is no clortriprolone anymore that I could find, but actually if you go and ask your pharmacist, you can get chlorpheniramine 4 milligram tablets generic behind the counter. And they are 12 cents a tablet compared to what you'd probably be paying, which is depending on where you buy it, maybe upwards of 50 to 60 cents a tablet or capsule of things like Allegra and so on. So I would start with 4 milligrams of chlorpheniramine, see how it worked. If I got sedated, I might go down to 2, especially if it worked. And then, but I certainly wouldn't go above 4 milligrams. That would be what I would try because it's less expensive. We also have long history of it not having to be taken off the market for some weird side effects. And so that's what I would do as far as an antihistamine. But I might be in the minority on this one. Because I think, you know, Allegra and Zyrtec and all those are so popular.
Well, here's what I took out of your story, Jane. And what I took out of it was that if I can come up with a drug that already has a long half-life and then call it extended release, even though it's the exact same drug, I could potentially make money. I'm going to be producing chlorpheniramine, chlorothalidone and fluoxetine extended release. I'm going to buy a lot of those generically and put them on the market as extended release.
Yeah. Well, it gets even worse. I'm sure Betsy's far too young for this to know this, but Mike, you're not. I don't think. I don't know if you remember. There used to be a whole bunch of enteric coded NSAIDs.
Oh, for goodness sake, Arthrotec and many others. Yeah.
Arthrotec was the one with misoprostol in it.
Yep. Oh, right. You're right. No, yeah.
I'm literally talking about a coding that went on.
Naprosyn EC and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And Enterofen was another one.
Yeah, Entrofen, Entrofen. Yeah, and we did an evaluation of this, and this is, again, 30 years ago, where we went, well, it's great, but you do realize that NSAID's effect on the gut are probably systemic. They're not local necessarily, except maybe aspirin, but that's another story. And I think if I remember correctly, back in the early 90s, we got to the point where those were all taken off the market, or they were not paid for by any companies anymore, or by any things like PharmaCare or anything, because they were a complete waste of time. And so enteric coating something also makes people feel like it's better, but the evidence was overwhelming that it didn't reduce GI side effects. So it's a crazy world that we live in. And antihistamines are crazy because we've had them since 1946, pretty much. So it is tricky.
Yeah, and we don't have great ways to sort a lot of this out because the scales are changing all the time. A lot of the data, I think, is hidden. A couple of them that did funnel plots, which are a way to check for publication bias, have these massive holes in them.
Oh, is that right?
Anyone can see from a mile away. So it's a bit frustrating, but this is the best evidence that we have.
Yeah. And the nice thing about it, you can get almost all of these over the counter. You know, you can buy them. And even the nasal steroids are now available, as you know, over the counter.
Yeah, I know.
And I went and checked out the price of the Flonase, and it was $36 for 120 sprays. So a little bit, maybe a little, depends how often you dose it. I know Betsy, you and I were talking about this earlier, just offline, about how often you're supposed to use the nasal steroids.
Right. Well, it was supposed to be, with that drug, the one you mentioned, it was supposed to be two puffs each nostril once a day. And some people use it more when things are really bad, and some people used it less, especially as they got feeling better and the adverse events reared their ugly head.
So that would do you if
as originally prescribed, it would do you for
one month. Yeah, basically. So that's a buck a day.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit more than if you were taking a single antihistamine a day.
Yeah. They can be relatively cheap, especially when bought in volume.
Yeah, but I totally agree on that. But I would suggest that that dose, a person who's using it should try to figure out the dose that works for them.
Yeah, for sure. You would start by spraying it in the air in a room once, and then walking around that room.
No, I wouldn't. That's too expensive.
Oh
yeah, no. I would just put my nose close to the canister.
Okay.
Yeah, without
dispensing.
Yeah.
Okay, is low dose.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, but don't forget about the placebo.
Don't forget. Yeah, you can spray placebo in your nose.
So
I think that covers it. It was also done. We should mention that Anthony Train also worked on this with us. And so we didn't mention that earlier, but we did look at a broader kind of issues of how to treat kind of chronic allergic rhinosinusitis or acute allergic rhinosinusitis. And it really, both elements work, the nasal puffers and the antihistamines, and you can pick any antihistamine you want. Nasal steroids work a little bit better.
Yeah. And so I think this is such a good topic, right? Because there's a lot, I don't know if you've noticed, a lot of people have allergies.
A lot of people have allergies. Lot of people.
And
especially this year. I've been hearing it's extra worse this year.
I've heard the same sort of thing as well. So now you have some really, at least now you know the best available evidence. You can help people make sort of decisions on this. Anything else you wanted to add, Betsy?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered all of
that. Yeah, no, great job. Mike, anything else?
Nope, that's it, James.
So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.